So I'd like you to tell you about some new work I've been doing with Jim Hartle, and it's based on earlier work in collaboration with Stephen Hawking on accelerated expansion and ADS-CFT. So over the years, there have been many attempts by many people, some of which in this room, to connect or to generalize ADS-CFT to cosmology. And so it was sort of an obvious question, even in the early days of ADS-CFT, can ADS-CFT be used for cosmology? And broadly speaking, you can divide these attempts in two classes. The first class of approaches, I should say, involves really to generalize ADS-CFT as far, Lorentzian ADS-CFT, as far as the boundary conditions is concerned, to allow for some interesting dynamics. Dynamics which forms cosmological singularities, or which introduces some other time dependency, or which provides an embedding of some cosmology in ADS, all sorts of attempts to include time dynamics, and in doing so, to use the dual to learn something about cosmological questions. There's another set of attempts which is mostly based on notions of analytic continuation between Euclidean ADS and Lorentzian de Sitter spaces. The analytic continuation essentially involves an analytic continuation of a wave function around Euclidean ADS, which one continues to a wave function in the Sitter space. So that applies, for instance, to the wave function for small perturbations, small fluctuations. You can show that these can indeed be continued into each other from ADS, Euclidean ADS, to Lorentzian de Sitter. So what have we learned from all these approaches? Well, from the first set of approaches, I think we've especially learned that it's quite difficult. The second set of approach, the analytic continuation, is interesting but limited. You can in fact show that the analytic continuation does not work away from perturbations around empty ADS or perturbations around empty de Sitter space. When you turn on matter fields, when you turn on backgrounds, so you're working with an asymptotic ADS space or an inflationary cosmology, it's not just an analytic continuation, as I will show later on. So what I would like to do today is to propose a novel application of ADS-CFT to cosmology, which is more general, more universal, and it comes around, it's inspired mostly on this approach, and it comes around from thinking about Euclidean ADS-CFT as a wave function, as a statement about the wave function of the universe. So the connection between ADS and de Sitter arises in our work, as I will explain in detail, at the level of the quantum state of the universe. And in a particular limit, it will reduce to the analytic continuations mentioned earlier. Okay, so Euclidean ADS-CFT has been viewed as a statement about the wave function of the universe, most notably in a paper by Horovitz and Malasina in 2004, where they noted that really you can view the partition function of Euclidean field theories as a statement evaluated using ADS saddle points as a statement about the wave function of the universe, because the partition function is a function of the boundary configuration of Euclidean ADS. Euclidean ADS is just hyperbolic space, so it has a spherical boundary. You can put some boundary values of the fields, the metric and the scalar fields and the gauge fields and so forth. The saddle points of ADS will be a function of those boundary values. And so really, you're very close to what a typical wave function of the universe will do for you, which is to assign an amplitude to different configurations on a boundary surface. And in this case, that's a sphere. Of course, we all know that long ago, Hartle and Hawking also made a proposal for the wave function of the universe, precisely along these lines. They considered a metric and field configuration on some space-like surface, take it to be a sphere for now, and they assigned an amplitude to different metric and field configurations using the sitter action, the Euclidean de Sitter action of the saddle point that matches onto that configuration. So I want to relate these two today. And because I have inside information that Rob is going to run away in a while, I'm going to give you the punchline. The punchline is that you can rewrite the complex saddle points that provide the same classical approximation to the no boundary wave function. You can rewrite those saddle points as complexified version of Euclidean ADS domain wall saddle points. Once you've rewritten the no boundary proposal in terms of an ADS language, well, then it's a very small step, of course, to use ADS-CFT to provide you with a potentially more precise formulation of the very same wave function. Okay, so that's the punchline, but I'll explain all how that comes about in the rest of my talk. So here's the outline. I will briefly review some key ideas about no boundary wave function, just the elements which will be relevant to the rest of my discussion. Then, as I just noted, I will rewrite the no boundary wave function in ADS language. And then that will provide the basis for a proposal to get to connect ADS-CFT to accelerating cosmologies. Okay, so in the original proposal of the no boundary wave function is here. It's due to Hartle and Hawking. And as I mentioned, it essentially assigns an amplitude to different configurations of metrics and scalar fields on space-like surfaces. The defining feature of the no boundary wave function is a regularity condition on the wave function when the scale factor is small. Now, the formulation they wrote down in terms of a Euclidean path integral, which is very much inspired by the ground state description of a harmonic oscillator, say, that formulation never really went very far. And so I don't think the Euclidean path integral really was ever defined properly. But semi-classically, when you're strict to saddle points, it provides an excellent toy model, so to speak, for what quantum cosmology is about, what you can do with it, and how it potentially fits into a more precise framework. Semi-classically, you look for saddle points of this integral, which match a prescribed configuration on a space-like surface. Because of the regularity condition, which is the defining feature of the no boundary state, those saddle points are generally complex because they glue essentially a Lorentzian inflationary spacetime onto a regular Euclidean regime of the saddle point. So essentially they round off Lorentzian inflationary universes which would otherwise be singular. So Stephen's motivation to round these off in a regular manner was precisely to have calculational control over the amplitude of different kinds of inflationary universes, right? But because these saddle points are complex, the Euclidean action will have a real and an imaginary part. Okay, there's a phase factor to the wave function, and there's the amplitude, so to speak. Now, that's good because wave functions with a large phase factor admit a WKB interpretation. In quantum mechanics, when the phase factor varies rapidly compared with respect to the boundary data, compared to the real part of the wave function, you're in a WKB regime, and you can interpret the evolution as the wave function as predicting classical evolution. But classical evolution in this case means classical evolution of the configuration of metric and field on a space-like surface. So it means really a classical Lorentzian spacetime, the usual starting point in cosmology. Okay? If you start from a wave function, you don't have a classical cosmological background. You better derive it. Well, it emerges from a wave function in the regime where what we call the classicality conditions hold. And the gradients there are with respect to the fields in the problem. So when those conditions hold, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation predicts classical evolution. It reduces to the usual Hamilton-Jacobi equation. And it also predicts that the real part of the Euclidean action of the saddle point is preserved along that evolution. Therefore, at the end of the day, what you end up with is a collection of classical cosmologies, classical backgrounds, and fluctuations, the whole thing. And each classical cosmology comes with a certain probability, relative probability. So that's sort of, in that way, a wave function of the universe realizes what is sometimes called a multiverse. In this case, it's not so much a multiverse consisting of a given space-time with a very complicated structure. It's more something as like an ensemble of different space-times which can differ from each other. Yeah, okay, so I'll come to that. So there are, of course, always many saddle points if you vary the bound, vary the data on the space-like surface. For different data on the on a space-like surface, you get a different saddle point. But you could also have many saddle points for given boundary data. And I'll come to those. In principle, you add these up. In practice, you hope you got the dominant one. Okay, so to write the no boundary wave function in terms of ADS language, we'll have to take a closer look at those complex saddle points that provide the same classical approximation. The most general complex saddle points can be represented in the complex time plane. Complex, I've indicated this by tau here. And so they're essentially curves, a representation of a saddle point, a geometric representation of a saddle point is a curve in the complex time plane. There's a south pole where the scale factor vanishes, and at which there are certain regularity conditions that need to be obeyed. That's, after all, the no boundary condition. And there's a final boundary somewhere in the complex tau plane, where, of course, the saddle point geometry has to match the boundary data for which you want to provide an amplitude. Now, there are many saddle points that obey these two conditions, generally, an infinite set. In a simple problem where you just have a metric and a scalar field, there will be the scalar field value, the complex scalar field value at the south pole that you can tune. And for different values of the faces, discrete values of the faces, you're going to get to some endpoint. The place of this endpoint can vary in the complex plane where these conditions hold. There is only one saddle point, however, for which, if you then go through the calculation, this condition holds for a given boundary data. So those are generally the saddle points that we have focused on. And why is this? Because if the tuning at the south pole is such as to allow for a classical history, then once you get to the classical history, the only contribution to the wave function is phase. Because the real part of the Euclidean action remains constant, the classical history only contributes phase. And so if you have a different tuning and you don't have a classical history, then to get to these large, to get to the final boundary will involve a lot of Euclidean action, so to speak, and those saddle, and that will suppress those saddle points relative to these classical ones. Yeah, so tau, this is just to parameterize complex time. Eh?
The really
magic. Yeah. And so I'm here a little bit going ahead. The model that I have in mind here, so you can work this out in very simple models. You can work this out explicitly, by which I mean you can calculate the entire ensemble of cosmologies. So here is a very simple model in which you would restrict by hand to homogeneous isotropic universes. So you only have a scale factor, which is a function of complex time, and a scalar field, which is a function of complex time. And the wave function will be a function of the final value of the scale factor in the scalar field, B and chi. And take a simple potential with a cosmological constant and a quadratic potential. And then you can look for complex solutions systematically. You can find them all. And you find that for a given absolute value of the scalar field at the south pole of the instanton, so at the origin of the universe, so to speak, there's one value of its phase, which if you take that value, you end up with a classical history. You end up with at the end point where you evaluate the wave function with a large phase factor that varies rapidly. And then you're into your WKB interpretation and so forth. So these different curves here correspond to different values of the mass over the cosmological constant. That's just to illustrate that if the mass is a bit larger than a critical value, you find no classical solutions at all. And then for low values of the mass, we have this curve, and you find one classical history for each value of the scalar field. Yeah, the mass of the scalar. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the mass over the cosmological constant, eh? So the a bit of an analog of the Brayton-Lorentz Friedmann bound in a Dissipi step.
Sorry, it's mass over the Hubble constant.
A Hubble constant defined by lambda, yes, m squared over lambda, yes, that's right,
So m squared over lambda is
3/2 or so, yeah, or 9/4, yeah.
Oh, I see. M squared over lambda is less than that value, then there is a solution.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So this is just to conclude. So the review part, so to speak, at the end of the day, as I mentioned, you're interested in the action of those saddle points because it's the action which gives you the relative probabilities of different cosmologies. And the action is calculated along any contour that connects the south pole to the end point where your saddle point matches the data you're interested in. Cauchy's theorem tells you that you can calculate the action along any contour. The convenient contour for calculating the action is, of course, to go and sit on the trajectory where the saddle point glues onto the classical cosmology, because then the phase factor takes it all, and the real part of the action tends to a constant, and you get, roughly speaking, the familiar minus 1 over v behavior of the no-boundary wave function. The prior probabilities favor a low value of the scalar field at early times. What are those cosmologies? Well, then you take the data at which on the surface at which you evaluate the wave function, and you regard these as Cauchy data for Lorentzian cosmologies. You can evolve these forward and backwards, and here's a sample of 5 such cosmologies evolved backwards in time in the phi H plane. H is A dot over A or B dot over B, so the local value of the Hubble rate, evolves backwards. You see that all these cosmologies lie on a sort of narrow line in this H phi diagram, and that's the line where H is equal to M times phi. M is the mass of the scalar field. That's a way of characterizing inflationary cosmologies. So this is, to me, one of the most stimulating results that have come out of the no-boundary idea, which is that without putting in inflation, you get it out. Okay. A priori, small amount. Yes.
Not enough.
Well, whether it's enough depends on whether it's enough depends on the conditional probabilities you're interested in. Eh? But at least it could have been. It could. We get some. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, the wiggly thing is then the evolution backwards in time goes that way. The wiggling thing, so you have to imagine forwards in time, the scalar field rolls down to small values, and then it then oscillates around its minimum of the potential.
Yes, aren't you choosing solutions current scan today is, and then, so classically, the scalar field is attracted to the inflationary trajectory as you can sort of see it forward. Is that what that's saying? Sort of wherever you start, then classically the field amps on the slow roll trajectory.
That's what we're finding, but that's not what we're putting in.
Well, you're putting in the boundary condition, right? When you're matched by the buoyancy of the field, you're taking the stationary.
Yes, that is a very good point. What the precise statement is here is that those universes that end up behaving like classical cosmologies have an early period of inflation. This is indeed a statement subject to Lorentzian classical spacetime. If you weren't putting this in, indeed, you would be in what Tanmay asked. There would be a whole range of other saddle points, which you would have to calculate, and those would correspond to quantum histories, which don't behave classically. So we put classicality in, and then we deduce that those classical universes have an early period of inflation.
It could be a classical cosmology, but phi is not classical. For example, I mean, if phi is in a thermal state, but then the universe is homogeneous.
Yeah, so we put to the precise statement, even more precise statement, is that we put in classicality on large, on a coarse grain scale. But there are simpler issues. You could have classicality and a large time gradient of phi, which would not correspond to any inflationary period. There are many other cosmologies you could consider.
That's kind of my question. So are you excluding those type of cosmologies that your geometry is classical, but your phi is not classical?
You mean as a whole, like a thermal vacuum state, or?
Yeah, I mean, phi has some thermal state, for example.
Yeah, and okay, so besides these cosmologies, there's only the empty de Sitter universe, which you could also view as a classical cosmology where phi is not behaving classically, just in the vacuum.
But you're assuming phi is classical,
Yes, on large scales. Yeah.
So I'm saying that's another possibility of deviating from this.
Yeah, you could generalize this. Yeah. But as long as you require the metric, the space time, to be classical, you'll have those histories.
Well, you could have large quantum fluctuations in phi, which amount to uniform density at larger scales, but that gives you a classical space time, but phi itself you cannot describe it as a classical field.
Yeah, but that okay. This is just backgrounds, okay. So if you include fluctuations, the story generalizes, and then you don't really need to assume classicality of the fluctuations on certainly not on small scales. But you need a background in order to talk about fluctuations. Okay, so there just as a aside, was there a beginning in quantum cosmology? Well, it depends on the question you're asking. The ensemble of universes includes both initially singular universes and universes advanced in the past. So the main points are, we have an ensemble of universes coming out of any quantum state of the universe. Classical universes are what's particularly interested in, classical space-time at least. And we get those by looking for complex solutions of a given Euclidean action. These are the three main points, and now we can move forward to the ADS form of the no-boundary wave function. So let's look again at those saddle points.
Can I just ask another question?
Well, I'm not sure.
you said the Euclidean part integral is not properly defined.
Well, yeah.
The formula which motivated the saddle point
wasn't. Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah. Okay, so that's a very good question. Yes, and I forgot to mention this. So one might wonder, okay, why are we interested in connecting this idea to Euclidean ADS CFD? This is certainly one major motivation to put the whole no boundary idea on firm footing. Okay.
So you want to throw away the gravitational.
That's right. That's right. So. That's right. At the end of my talk, the starting point will not be the full Euclidean path integral. It will be rather the dual field theorem. And then what do we get out of this? It's not the full path integral, but it's in a certain limit a semi-classical approximation. The other motivation, so whilst I'm at it, the other motivation which originally was behind this line of work was the treatment of eternal inflation in no-boundary cosmology. There you might think, well, using the saddle point approximation is sort of a stretch, because typically fluctuations are large, and so you might think, okay, is this all well under control? And of course, if you have a more precise formulation of the no-boundary wave function, then you might hope to get a better handle on eternal inflation. But we're not there yet. But that's sort of the long-term idea. Okay, so to get to write this whole thing in ADS form is extremely simple, okay? These were the saddle points. And so I'm going to give you first a very simple, the simplest case. No matter, no scalar field, purely just a cosmological constant and gravity. This is the saddle point. It's the only one. A is sine h tau in the complex time plane. So then what you see is that the saddle point is essentially Euclidean de Sitter space, a four sphere matched smoothly onto Lorentzian de Sitter space written here. Okay? These are nothing but the canonical representations of the no-boundary saddle points. You glue Euclidean de Sitter onto Lorentzian de Sitter. Here is a representation of the very same saddle point along a different contour, going to the same endpoint where it matches the same value of the scale factor. Surprise, surprise, along the vertical part of this contour, the saddle point geometry is hyperbolic space. It's Euclidean anti-de Sitter space. So instead of having this representation, which is really a geometric representation of that contour, if we represent the saddle point geometrically along a different contour, we find that the Euclidean regime is in fact anti-de Sitter space. So this saddle point is like the universe becomes large in the Euclidean, and then you have a transition region that matches onto the final surface. And if you add matter, the only thing that happens is that, as before, the Euclidean, the Sitter saddle point, they deform and they become complex. Here as well, the Euclidean anti-de Sitter metric deforms and becomes the Euclidean ADS domain wall.
Yes.
Yes, it's the same saddle point.
Just analytic.
Yes. Yes. These are complex analytic solutions in the complex time plane, and that's what it is. So what's happening along the vertical part of this contour is that the effective potential that we started with is in fact minus the original potential and minus the original cosmological constant. So you might wonder, well, why is this possible? And the key point is that the saddle points are complex solutions. Okay? The same classical approximation to the wave function is provided by complex solutions, but complex solutions become real in different domains of the complex time plane. And depending on the domain where they are real, a given potential and a given cosmological constant in the Lagrangian will act as a positive or a negative cosmological constant. That follows, in fact, straightforwardly from if you look at the action and if you're thinking about the metric not as a real Lorentzian metric but as a complex metric, you will see that you effectively have an ADS action in one domain and a de Sitter action in another domain. So that's just technically what's behind the fact that you get different real domains where the cosmological constant acts positively or negatively in one complex plane for one complex solution. This is a little bit reminiscent of the so-called domain wall cosmology correspondence in supergravity, which was originally thought of as a continuation between two different theories. An ADS theory continued in the cosmological constant and the time coordinate to a DS theory. But in the later papers on the domain wall cosmology correspondency, you do have the notion of one complexified theory. A little bit reminiscent of that. But it's certainly not a continuation between different theories. We have one theory, one Lagrangian, one solution, one complex solution. And in fact, it's an appropriate point to point out the difference between this and the analytic continuation employed before. Of course, there is somewhere in this complex time plane also an ADS solution, an ADS saddle point, so to speak. So we have these complex asymptotically de Sitter saddle points, which are Euclidean ADS domain walls going over into a complex region matching onto an endpoint where the classicality conditions hold. But apart from those solutions, we have a different class of saddle points, which are purely real Euclidean ADS domain walls, and they end on a spherical boundary, which is ADS. Those you find by just taking real values of the scalar field at the South Pole, you go up straight, you end there, and that's it. And those will describe Euclidean ADS saddle points. Clearly, because they're purely real, they're going to have nothing to do with classical cosmology. So they're an example of what you asked before, completely different class of saddle points. Yes, they exist. That's clear. So you might wonder, well, how is it possible to have a real Euclidean ADS domain wall here and another ADS domain wall there, and one corresponds to a classical cosmology and another one doesn't? And the difference lies in the fact whether you take a real scalar field at the South Pole or a complex value of the scalar field. If you take to get those saddle points to correspond to classical cosmologies, you need a large phase factor. That fixes, in fact, the phase at the South Pole of the complex field, and it fixes also the asymptotic phase of the scalar field in the ADS domain of the saddle point. So asymptotically, along this line, the scalar field will decay as a combination of these two familiar modes in ADS, lambda minus and lambda plus depend on the mass of the scalar field, and the phase factor of alpha will be fixed by the condition that you end up with a real configuration at the saddle point. That's sort of a technical point, but it's important to make the distinction between the real Euclidean ADS saddle points and the complex ADS saddle points that correspond to classical cosmology. Because that distinction is the reason why it's not just a continuation from ADS to DS in general, because that would neglect this phase factor. If you neglect that phase factor, your action will be different, your probabilities will be different, and your predictions will be different. So this is really clearly, if you turn off the background scalar field, you set alpha equal to 0 or chi equal to 0, and the problem indeed reduces. These two lines coincide in the limit when matter is turned off, and indeed you recover the analytic continuation results of Maldacena and others. Still, there are many questions that are open now at this point. And here are some of the key questions, I'd say. Does this connection between n de Sitter and de Sitter really hold for general saddle points? I've only given you a homogeneous toy model, so to speak. Does it hold beyond the saddle point approximation? And to be useful, we better get a very simple connection between the ADS, the asymptotic ADS regime, and the boundary where we evaluate a wave function, where we match onto a inflationary cosmology. Because if we don't have a simple connection across this horizontal branch, then clearly the ADS behavior of the saddle point is going to be useless from a calculational point of view. So we set out more recently then to address these questions. And it turns out that, the framework in which you have to analyze those questions is really purely the asymptotic structure. It turns out that much of what I said is pretty much independent of the specific no boundary condition of regularity. The ADS, the sitter connection, is really a feature of the asymptotic regimes of the saddle points. And so you can consider any wave function, impose the Wheeler-DeWitt constraint. From the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, you will find that the leading terms in the wave function are in fact universal, by which I mean they are purely determined in terms of the argument of the wave function, and independent of the specific boundary conditions when the universe is small. And once you have the leading terms of the asymptotic wave function at a large scale factor, well, then the relation between momenta and gradients of the action gives for you an asymptotic structure in quantum cosmology. And that asymptotic structure is the one that we use all the time in ADS-CFT, the Pfefferman-Graham expansions. You get them out in this way in quantum cosmology. Once you have the Pfefferman-Graham expansions, you can stare at those. So this is completely general, okay? Now Hij is a boundary conformal structure, and alpha is a boundary configuration of the field. These are the boundary data which you put in, and then the next terms are determined up to a certain term, which is going to depend on the specific wave function. But if you stare at those expressions, you see that you will have an asymptotic ADS behavior, and then a pi over 2 in the complex time plane, pi over 2 away, you will have an asymptotic de Sitter behavior. Okay, so put differently, what we get out are complex versions of the previous Pfefferman-Graham expansions in ADS-CFT. So that ADS de Sitter connection is really a property of the asymptotic structure of the theory. And that was the key result, which allowed us, in fact, to calculate the relation between the action here in the asymptotic ADS regime and the action of the saddle point at the boundary where we glue onto the cosmologies. So first, the action, the total action, of course, will be a sum of this part and then this part. Along the vertical part, we have Euclidean ADS-CFT. So the gravity action will be what is in ADS-CFT called the regularized ADS action, depending on the asymptotic boundary data of the ADS regime of the saddle point, and a bunch of counterterms, which we cannot cancel here, because where would the cancellation come from? We're evaluating the saddle point action as it is. The regularized ADS action is finite when the scale factor goes to infinity, and so here you have corrections of order 1 over the scale factor. Now let's go to the horizontal part of the action. So this we cannot, the regularized ADS action we cannot determine from the ADS, from the asymptotic structure, okay? This depends on the behavior of the saddle point or on the boundary conditions of the wave function for small scale factor. But it turns out that the action across the horizontal part is purely given in terms of the asymptotic structure. And what you get is minus the same counterterms, the ADS counterterms, plus I times, again, the same factor. And those counterterms are just the same counterterms as the one we use in ADS-CFT. So what we find here is that the action of the good old no boundary instantons, the total action is in fact the regularized ADS action of the ADS domain of the saddle points plus a phase factor, which is the counterterms usually employed in ADS-CFT, but now with an I in front of these. The divergences are all canceled. The horizontal part of the contour cancels automatically the divergences of the ADS action across the vertical part. And so at the end of the day, now I arrive at the end of part two of my talk, here is the ADS form of the no-boundary wave function. Semi-classical so far, it involves the regularized ADS action of a corresponding ADS domain wall regime, which is purely determined. The data here are determined by the argument of the wave function, and it involves a big phase factor, the phase factor is in fact the usual counterterms of ADS CFT with an I in front. So that's the result of a calculation. Okay, this is at the semi-classical level, an exact result which holds for completely general saddle points with spherical topology, yeah, the boundary. Okay, so now it's a small step to reverse the entire reasoning. I didn't, and this is included in the regularized ADS. Yeah, it's the fact that the scalar field profile across the Euclidean ADS domain wall has a phase. And that causes this little shift, and it must be included in this regularized ADS action. No, 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 no. This thing is complex. It's finite but complex. Yes. Just as the old no-boundary instantons in a quadratic potential involve the phase of the scalar field and were complex. Yes. Okay, that's a different way of phrasing the difference between a straight analytic continuation from real Euclidean ADS to Lorentzian de Sitter. In that case, this thing is real, but we have complex saddle points.
Right. So IR ADS is complex in general.
Yeah.
But SCT is real.
That's right.
Okay, but
yeah.
It's imaginary because you call it
IR. Right, yeah.
I think the basic question, after the continuation of ADS, where the expansions of fields in the boundary, right? What you just shown.
Yeah.
Yeah, these are complex, right?
That's right. So what is your question? What is complex here?
Yeah.
Yeah. So alpha is complex. Alpha has this phase factor determined by the argument of the wave function.
So this component, this expansion, a meaning in the dual.
Aha,
right.
I will come to that, of course.
One of the expansion in the metric would be the potential value of the specific.
Yeah, but this is okay. So this is real, right, to leading order. The conformal structure I haven't changed. That doesn't change across the horizontal branch. But I'll come to that right now. You're quite right. The generalization of ADS CFT that I will propose is precisely a generalization to allow complex values of alpha. Okay, so that is the generalization that I will propose.
Alpha corresponds to the expectation value of the scalar field.
Exactly. So alpha means alpha enters as an external deformation in the CFT. So what we're gonna end up doing is to consider a CFT, and instead of considering real relevant deformations, I'm going to allow for complex relevant deformation. Yeah.
Explain why the Einstein action disappeared on the horizontal part of the contour.
Yeah, so the finite part of Okay, so what's the simplest explanation for this? It doesn't disappear, right? So the Einstein action is responsible for, in fact, generating all these counterterms which cancel the divergences of the ADS part. But it's a consequence of the Einstein equations, in fact, that the real part on the ADS regime is unchanged across the horizontal branch. I don't have a good physical intuition. I think it has to do. I sometimes think of it as a no-hair property. The reason that the constant part doesn't change has to do with the fact that gradients follow sufficiently fast. Okay.
It's only an approximate statement.
It's a statement up to it's an exact statement, but there are corrections of order 1 over b then again.
What's b?
B is the scale factor. So.
Oh.
The contribution of the horizontal branch.
So you kind of go far up.
That's right.
And then you go across.
Yeah.
B is large.
Yes. Uh-huh. And so then all these B's. It's an asymptotic statement. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's.
I didn't get to the question yet.
Sorry?
I didn't
didn't get to ask the question yet.
You didn't?
I want to ask the question.
Didn't hear the question.
Ah.
No, he didn't ask.
No, he said he didn't get to ask the question he wanted to.
Okay, well, go ahead.
There was no conspiracy.
So, but make sure I understand. The expansion of the metric is always there.
Yes.
The only thing that is complex is the...
That's right. That's right.
And the CFT, which is solves, is unitary.
It's a Euclidean CFT. Huh?
Yeah.
So... Well, if the path integral that defines the partition function, you see. Well, if it doesn't diverge, it's going to blow up, right? I'll come to that.
Yeah, I mean, you might have said it earlier, but I still miss it. So you go up vertical to get the ABS part, but what obligates this straight horizontal trajectory to the, I mean, you could wander
calculation simplicity. Yeah, I know, of course. Yeah.
Okay, but I mean, see, couldn't the answer be rather different?
No. Whatever trajectory you choose, you always get the same answer at the end. That's Cauchy's theorem.
You're assuming there aren't any poles or
branch
cuts, for example.
I'm not continuing in between theories. I'm continuing a complex analytic solution of a given theory. There are the solutions that I know of, the Celeron solutions that I know of, have no poles. This is very different from trying to continue some path integral across singularity and determine which saddle points contribute. This is an extension.
Yeah, you know, there's no poles, no branch cuts.
Yeah,
cuts.
Well, if you do that, then you have to sort of be more careful. So now I come to the ADS CFT part to which the questions were alluded to. Eh? Okay, so I'm going to go back to the first slide, but now I have rewritten the no-boundary wave function in its ADS form. We had the Euclidean ADS-CFT, we combined these, and that's our proposal. And the situation is a little more subtle than just working at infinite scale factor, because a finite scale factor moves in, if we want to evaluate the wave function at the finite scale factor, that moves in the boundary to a finite distance, and so you have the usual cutoff story in ADS-CFT, the scale factor corresponds to the cutoff. So one can take the holographic form of the no-boundary wave function as a starting point then and evaluate it using ADS-CFT. So now I start with the partition function as a function of the different boundary data, and I find two sets of saddle points. They're the usual real Euclidean ADS saddle points, which I mentioned before. So it's the same story, just the reasoning reversed. Okay, we start with a partition function, which is dual to an ADS theory. We look for real Euclidean ADS domain wall solutions. There they are. And we propose to also look for complex versions of those domain wall solutions, which, if you look carefully in the complex plane, will describe saddle points that correspond to inflationary universes. And the generalization is precisely complex chi, so complex chi tilde there, so complex deformations of a given CFT. In fact, here it's written, eh? Chi is the boundary value of the scalar field. Yeah, I've made a distinction between phi, which is the value at... Yeah, exactly, yeah. So here, this is perhaps the most relevant slide still. So that's the starting point for a dual description of the no-boundary wave function and for starting with ADS-CFT. And the chi is really, it enters as a deformation. This expectation value involves the Euclidean field theory action. So that's a path integral. With an extra term, where chi enters as a parameter, and a classical parameter. And now I'm going to allow for, in general, complex values of chi. And that's what gives rise to this whole set of saddle points, which are very interesting from a cosmological point of view. So now the question was asked, well, okay, what about divergences and so forth? Indeed, generally in ADS-CFT, and this was noted in the very first papers, if you deviate too much from a round sphere, or if you deform the theory by too much, the partition function will diverge. That's probably going to be the case there too. Well, I don't care. because the wave function involves 1 over z. Okay? If z diverges, what is happening is I'm suppressing those configurations in the wave function. And so the favored configurations will in fact be the round configurations, just as we had in the original no boundary idea. Now there are many other comments to make, as you see here.
No.
There's a function of the configuration. The wave function is a function of the configuration. If you fix the configuration, you get your saddle point. You change your configuration, you get a different saddle point. If in the end, an observationally interesting question that you want to ask involves probabilities that sum over certain saddle points, at that level, you're going to have to sum.
So you're summing the size.
Whatever. I'm summing the actions of the saddle points at that point. Yeah. Right. But that's at the level, it's one step later. I haven't discussed this. It's really when you're going to ask questions about probabilities involving groups of ensemble of saddle points. Okay, so these remarks. How did we get away by so simply and asymptotically relating Euclidean ADS-CFT and the no-boundary wave function? I wondered for that about a while, but then really what's going on in ADS-CFT is it also implements the no-boundary condition of regularity. All these saddle points are regular in the interior, which is a reflection of the requirement that the field theories be well-behaved in the IR. So really those ideas as far as the specific wave function is concerned are very similar. We have some other, that 1 over z factor is also, in fact, what enters in the, if you go from the higher spin realization of DS-CFT, when you go from the ADS theory to the DS theory, there you can do the analytic continuation. So it's a limit in which the analytic continuation applies. You can also do it in the field theory. And what you do is you change bosons to fermions, which essentially is like taking z to 1 over z in the new theory. But they formulate it rather differently. But it certainly resonates. Okay, so here are my conclusions. The main point of my talk is really this novel connection between Euclidean ADS and Lorentzian de Sitter. It's a connection at the level of the wave function that utilizes the complexified theory. And the complexified theory is what's behind quantum cosmology. As Neil asked before, a main motivation of this is to potentially provide a better formulation of the no-boundary idea and then to apply it to the problem of eternal inflation. Okay, thanks very much.
Questions? So just to clarify, basically the root essence of this idea is the old-fashioned way of doing quantum cosmology along one contour, you're saying, is equivalent to this other way because you can always deform a contour. That's the core of the idea, right? Nothing.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, and then from the ADS CFT point of view, the complex generalization that comes with it.
Okay.
Yeah.
The original worry about the ADS, about the Euclidean half integral, was that there were other contributions that were bigger than the saddle point contribution. How does that somehow?
That is a very good question. I don't really know what happens in ADS-CFT with all the old worries. So you're quite right, that both are much more closely related now. So you might wonder, well, what's happening with all these old problems in the context of ADS-CFT?
You might destroy ADS-CFT.
Like the conformal factor rotation and so forth. Somehow the CFT provides a resolution of this, but quite how that works, it's a very good open question, I think. Many of the problems, of the old problems, this is one example, but many of the things we have done in ABS CFT, we can now relate to cosmology and vice versa, and that is one of the questions.
Does the horizontal contour, does that contribute to more the size square? Does that just interesting plays? I mean, we're interested in probability squares.
When you talk about probabilities, you don't talk. You talk about the regularized ADS action,
right?
Or, yeah. So it does not contribute to that part. Exactly. So the bottom line of this is, and I should have said this, I can calculate my probabilities in cosmology, CMB two-point functions, and so forth from the ADS regime. Once this is in place, you can really stick to the ADS side. You don't have to go. The rest is just counter-terms. No, because I'm calculating the probabilities from a complexified, from a Euclidean ADS domain one, which is a complex, which has a complex scalar field profile. That's the key difference.
Yeah.
The regularized ADS action will, as Neil was asking, will be complex, whereas if you, yeah. But it's not in contradiction with I think with what you have done so far. But if you were to go further and include tilt and the whole thing, then this would matter. Yeah.
So is here, are you going to let this tilt be complex in general, or somehow go and look as complex B is nailed down by boundary conditions?
Well, the asymptotic phase of the scalar field in the ADS regime is fixed by the argument of the wave function by the boundary conditions. But then its phase will vary across the settle point, of course.
Okay.
Okay, so, that is dynamical question.
So in that case, my worry is, something from the field theory I was saying, I think from the gravity of B1B, I worry, okay, clearly there are going to be configurations with effectively negative energy.
Sorry?
Clearly there are going to be configurations where, you know, I make this complex, so I have these gradient terms have the wrong sign, I'm going to have field theory with the actions and energies which are embedded from below, but
all
looks like a real problem.
All I'm using the field theory and the saddle points for is to calculate my wave function. Once you have your wave function, you're into, and you have identified a classical regime in which it's just cosmology, there's no complex stuff hanging around. It's purely real classical cosmology. It only comes with the probability. It's a very important distinction between the complexified theory that enters at the level of the wave function and the real classical cosmologies that we then use to do cosmology in the end, as cosmological that we then interpret as.
Okay, so you say it's essentially analogous to usual contour rotation. It's like, yes, it looks bad there, but you're sticking to the saddle point, so that's why you're okay.
Could you just explain what you mean by a better handle on the boundary rotation?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm not going to say what it is, but because I don't know it yet. But the motivation is clear. We have the saddle point approximation to the old no-boundary wave function is questionable in the regime of Wittering inflation because the average fluctuations are large. I'm not saying it's wrong or right. It's just difficult to gauge or to judge whether it's wrong or right. So we were thinking, well, if we can excise the regime of Wittering inflation by the partition function of a dual field theory on the exit surface of Wittering inflation, once you go into slow roll, then in line with the general law in ADS CFT, the partition function will sum up all quantum and loop corrections in the regime of Wittering inflation as a function of the boundary data. So that would free ourselves from having to consider the having to restrict ourselves to the saddle point approximation. That's the motivation. But good luck in calculating these field theory partition.
Doesn't that kind of assume that the generic history before then is internal inflation? Is that something that you show?
No, because in this ensemble of saddle points, there will be a subset of saddle points which have no internal inflation. Those saddle points are just slow roll inflationary, correspond to slow roll inflationary solutions. Those we can treat in the saddle point approximation. That's all fine. But then there's this other subset of saddle points where the scalar field is too high at the south pole of the saddle point, which have this regime of Wittering inflation at early times. So then you have to find find a new calculational technique to treat those, and then you're going to have to compare the probabilities of both. And then, okay, you're in this kind of more observational question. Whether or not eternal inflation is predicted is, in principle, a question you could try to answer using this book.
Any other questions?